Planned giving. What is the difference between planned giving and ordinary giving? I made the mistake of asking one of our staff that one day, and he looked at me kind of strangely. He said, well, I guess planned giving is giving in a planned way. And never asked that question again. Briefly, to explain the difference between a planned gift and ordinary, and this says ordinary income, and it's supposed to be ordinary gift. Sorry about that. If you change that on your notes. Ordinary giving. An ordinary gift, if you were to write it, or when you write a check to your church or to the Navigators or other Christian organizations or other charities, or give a cash gift, that is a... It's a completed gift. There are no strings. You may be able to designate how you'd like to see that gift used within the organization, but you can't take it back. You can't redirect it as a rule. It's a completed gift in order to be tax deductible. It's usually cash, but it can be anything of value. But cash is the most common means of making a what I call an ordinary gift. And it's generally of immediate use to the organization. Occasionally funds are placed into endowment programs that will fund future ongoing programs. But usually most gifts are made for immediate use. So when a person gives to a Navigator rep, for example, we process those funds and send the check out on a regular basis, and he or she immediately spend the funds to meet their personal needs or their ministry needs or what have you. Now, planned gift comes in a different category. A planned gift, generally speaking, is a current agreement for a future use. And that will become clear as we go along, I hope. But it may involve a transfer of assets at this point, and it may not. It may just involve an agreement to transfer assets in the future for use in the ministry. And almost always with a planned gift, the organization does not immediately benefit from those assets. Those assets are scheduled for use in the future. Because the assets have to be available to benefit the donor during their lifetime. So in a planned gift, you have two beneficiaries. You have the organization that the gift is given to, and you have the donor who retains some interest in those in that gift. Whether it's an annuity, lifetime annuity, whether it's a lifetime use of the asset, and so on. Planned gifts can be used as a means of reducing income taxes, because with many planned gifts, not all, but with many planned gifts, there's a tax deduction. Now, if you were to give X amount of dollars to the Lord's work in an immediate gift, you would have a tax deduction for X amount of dollars. If you give X amount of dollars in a planned gift, the tax deduction is reduced based on the IRS estimation of the degree of benefit you are going to receive back, as opposed to how much benefit the organization will receive. This will become clear later on. So it's a means of reducing income taxes. It's also a means of avoiding taxes on capital gains. If I have a stock that I have invested in and I sell it and give the proceeds to the Navigators, I pay the capital gains on that tax on the gain on that stock. If I instead give that stock to the Navigators or to your church or what have you, or my church, there's no tax on the gain, because the church or the Navigators or the charity is a tax-exempt organization. It's also a means of reducing estate taxes and probate costs, and we'll illustrate that later on. The purpose of the Navigator Department of Planned Giving is simple. Our purpose is to help Christians maximize the distribution of their resources to loved ones and to the Lord's work through the use of estate and financial planning. That's our goal. And our priorities are laid out in our goal. We feel, based on 1 Timothy 5:8, a person's first priority is to their family. Then as God leads and God enables them to make a gift to the Lord's work. It's a ministry to the body of Christ. The agreements we become involved in more often than not benefit more than just the navigators. Yes, sir?
What is the reference that you use?
1 Timothy 5:8. And I'm going to blank on it immediately. I didn't bring my Bible. But if any provide not for his own, especially for his own household, he both denies the faith and is worse than an individual. I think that's pretty close. 1 Timothy. Don't tell Jerry White, all right? That's 1 Timothy 5:8 in the original translation, the King James. Right. You bet. And we serve with no strings attached. I was, in fact, one of the agreements that we're going to illustrate today, or one of the plans we put together to illustrate today. One of the first things the donor asked me, he said, "Well, how much do the navigators have to benefit from this?" And I said, "Well, frankly, I've never been told. We don't have a criteria. In fact, sometimes we work with people where there is no benefit to the navigators, because again, we are here to serve. We are here to serve."
What do you mean by that? There's no benefit to the navigators of the funds that are given. Or
that's correct.
Or your services or what?
That's correct. Both. One unique illustration. We won't do this every day, obviously. Otherwise, we wouldn't be around. But we were approached by a local CPA here in Colorado Springs a couple years ago. And he had a client who wanted to make a gift to two churches in Colorado Springs. But and it was a unit trust, which involved a lifetime income going back to the lady. And when she's with the Lord, then the assets would be used by the churches in their ministry. But she didn't trust church financial management. But she liked the navigators. And would we assist in setting up this unit trust, and would we be the trustees? And he said, "I'm not really sure there'll be anything in the navigators in this trust, because she hasn't talked about that." I talked to Rod Sargent, who was my boss at that time, is now with the Lord. He said, "Well, let's go ahead and do it." And so we set up the, I almost said the name, the trust, and the lady is receiving income, and for about, I think it's a couple $100,000 of assets, and two churches in Colorado Springs will benefit, and the NAVs have no interest in the arrangement, except as a fiduciary. Yes?
The trustees' service, the navigator service.
In this situation, we do serve as trustee.
Who signed on behalf of the navigator?
Rod Sargent.
Are there other situations where the navigators are serving as?
Quite a few. I would say, I don't have an estimate, but I would say probably either trustee or co-trustee, perhaps a few hundred.
And you do not manage the equity base that's in these trusts?
Yes, we do.
You do manage it?
Yeah, we have advisors and who advise us, I don't personally. No. It's our corporate accounting department that manages them. And that's not unusual for many organizations. There are pluses and minuses in being a fiduciary. We do not charge for our fiduciary services. Generally speaking, we will take on an obligation like that, and this is going to be in contrast to what I just said, when there is an eventual gift to the navigators in the arrangement. But and of course, it's like this trust I just described. If we did many of those, we wouldn't be around. Our costs would exceed our income. Okay, next page. Tools of planned giving. Just a quick summary. Bequest, of course, that refers to a will. There's all kind, and that's the simplest, most direct way. And as I say when I put on seminars, that's the way everybody can make a planned gift. Even a person with a modest estate could include the navigators as a contingent beneficiary in their will. Which would mean if all of their heirs predecease them, and there's no and their will does not direct the money to go anywhere, then the NAVs then the funds could go to the NAVs or their church or what have you. Life insurance is a good way of making a planned gift. A gift annuity is a fixed lifetime income guaranteed by the organization. Personally, I don't like annuities unless a person is older. What is older? That's a relative term, and it's changing. Generally speaking, I don't think a person should enter into an annuity unless they are well into their 60s, in my personal opinion. We don't do much with annuities. A deferred gift annuity is a unique arrangement. It's a fixed lifetime income starting at a future date. Pardon me, that future date is specified in the contract. If a person were to have a large income at a particular period of time and he wanted to make a charitable gift and he wanted to receive a current income tax deduction and he wanted to receive a retirement income sometime in the future, they could enter into a deferred gift annuity and would receive an income tax deduction and guarantee a future income. An annuity trust is very similar, except unlike the annuity, the assets in annuity trust are backed up by the assets actually placed in trust. If a person enters into an annuity with the Navigators, they're backed up by all of our resources, including Glenary. It's a contractual obligation. Charitable remainder unit trust. It's an annual payment of a fixed percentage of the annually determined value of the trust assets. So, for example, if a trust says, well, the minimum by law is 5%. I've never seen one written for over 10%. But we'll use 5% if using just round figures, if $100,000 is placed in the unit trust and the 5% return, that means the first year the donor would receive $5,000 in income. And that income is favorably treated by the IRS. It is taxable, but it's favorably treated. Assuming the trust earned 10%, the excess 5% would be kept in the trust, and next year the donor would receive 5% of $105,000. So it's a variable. Of course, conversely, if the trust drops in value, as in a few Mondays ago, then the income would go down. But it's a variable, as in contrast to the annuity concept. Life estate contract. Sometimes a person has a farm or a personal residence they really want to see used in the ministry, either actually physically or sold and eventually used in the ministry. And you can enter into an agreement, either revocable or irrevocable in this situation, where you maintain the right to use and benefit from the property during your lifetime. You also have the right to maintain it, or the responsibility to maintain it, keep it up. You can rent it, live in it, whatever you want. But at your death, the property goes to, if it's a couple at the death of both spouses, the property goes as a gift to the charity or charities, depending on the contract. Pooled income fund. Don't quote me. SEC would get mad. But it's sort of like a mutual fund. Same concept, but it has a charitable gift behind it. Gifts are commingled in an investment fund. And the donor receives a proportionate income owned by the fund based upon the amount of his contribution in relation to the other contributions. And a revocable trust, donor can take back the gift of future use of assets. In other words, we had a man, some years ago, give us some gold and silver coins and some bullion. And he said, I don't think I will ever need these. My wife and I will ever need these, but in case we do, I'll want to take them back. We placed them into a revocable trust. He kept them there for 6-7 years, wrote a letter saying, I'll never need those. Revoked the trust and made the gift. So gives flexibility to the donor, and I think that's very, very important. Questions so far?
Yes. Did you liquidate the coins?
We still have them.
And do you monitor the coins?
Daily.
Like I said, it's pretty easy to do nowadays.
Yeah, right, it is. Now, we could probably sell the gold coins because the numismatic, thank you, is far more valuable than the gold content. They're not going to fluctuate very much.
Have you had them certified?
We had them, yes. We had them certified when we received them, when we initially received them. And then when he revoked the trust, we had them looked at again and valued. And now we're just waiting for what we feel is appropriate time, which is
your retirement, isn't it?
My retirement. I wish. Yeah, it's one of the fun things you do. I think challenging, interesting. Next page. Important factors in planning. These are the issues we address when we work with individuals or families, couples. Age, occupation, marital status, children. Support obligations. What obligations does the family have, the couple, the adult? There may be other people other than the children and the spouses. There may be parents involved, which is not unusual at all in this day and age. Brothers and sisters, other relatives that they have an obligation to or feel an obligation to before the Lord. Previous marriages. Any special considerations of income or future need of assets. We do get into the estate of the individual, their assets, their property, coming up with a statement of net worth. And more fundamentally, what their objectives are, the plans, plans for their family, plans for the Lord's work, what they want to accomplish, and how they want their estate distributed, the needs of the family. And, of course, that takes priority. We also like to work with their planners. When we prepare a document, and Bill will prepare some of ours, many of ours, and we have another attorney that's on retainer that does other that will also prepare documents for us. We are reluctant to go into a donor with a document and sit down and have them sign it, whether it's a unit trust or a revocable trust or what have you. We prefer to have that donor have his own attorney review the document and counsel his client on how the document should be changed and the strengths and minuses of the agreement. That way we feel the donor's interests are being protected. And that's very important. Because we try to do a good job, but we have our perspective and there are more perspectives than just ours. And also we look carefully at an individual's need for various kinds of protection, whether it's death, disability, retirement needs, income tax, hazards, emergencies, liability. And these things can be addressed through good estate planning. Questions so far? Well, we said we're going to go through some scenarios, and that's what I'm going to do. The first one is a gentleman and his wife. One single son living at home. Turned out he has three other children, which I didn't know at first. What we discovered when we went through this kind of a checklist with them, married and living all at some distance from where they are. He is 68, she is 63. Financial need, the rest of the family were self-sufficient, independent, had no needs, but the donor and his wife were concerned about retirement income. Everybody's health was good. The donor and the wife both said that she needed financial management. If he predeceased her, she would be in trouble with their current arrangement. Now, these are the donor's own plans. He listed these, and they're an approximate priority. First of all, he was concerned about providing retirement income. Secondly, he, as I said, wanted financial management for his wife. Or that provision, I should say. He was very concerned about reducing taxes and reducing estate, both income and estate, and probate expenses. He didn't like capital gains taxes, and you'll see why in a few moments. He wanted to provide a gift to his kids, and he wanted to provide a gift to the Lord's work. And he wanted to simplify his estate administration. Brief summary of his property. You'll see why he didn't like capital gains, because he had a...
Hi.
Welcome.
The only woman in here.
But you add a little class to the outfit.
Okay.
Good to have you here. We're on about third or fourth page in, I'd say.
Okay.
We just started the first scenario. Right.
Okay.
Oh no, that's no problem. Just a real quick review. This is an actual situation that. We worked with, Bill and I worked with both this last year, and the last part of the plan was implemented this month, or will be implemented this month. The first part was implemented last month. And this is a man, 68, wife, age 63, who was quite charitably motivated, yet wanted to benefit his family and himself. And you can review the other pages, and that'll give you the background. Looking at his net worth... one of the things I said, he didn't like taxes on cap on gain. And you can see he had rental property, which the business interests are. with a net worth value of about $800,000 and a cost basis of just under $100,000. That would be quite a significant capital gain, tax on capital gains. Now, I put the comparison of the old and new estate plans first because what we did is a little complicated. And I wanted to show you the benefits so you understand, so you put up with the complications. Under his old estate plan, it was fairly simple. Everything went to his wife, and then everything went to the kids. In that arrangement, administrative costs, administration costs were estimated at about 5%, which is about $111,000.
What do you mean by administration?
The cost of probate, cost of death, funeral expenses, and so on. You can't get away, but the probate is the primary thing you can affect. With the administration, so we estimate about $111,000. Estate taxes, that should be, pardon me for the and, $382,000, and that is just federal. This particular state in which he lives has state estate taxes, and one of the ways I avoid practicing law is by not knowing what state laws are. Bill likes that. He likes me to keep out of his area of expertise. And because of the, and then about $652,000, distributed to kids, and zero distribution to the Lord's work. So going back on his goals, you can see that he had some things he was accomplishing and some things he wasn't accomplishing. All right. With the new estate plan, which you'll see on the next page, administrative costs were drastically reduced, $33,000. Estate taxes, federal, zero. Again, bear in mind, these are all projections. You know. Distribution to children went up, and somehow we found another almost $900,000 to distribute to the Lord's work. Now this is not typical, but this illustrates what can be done. Next page, new estate plan. First of all, a poorer will was prepared, and what that means is that anything that was outside of the trust arrangements that was probated, according to the terms of the will, would be placed into the revocable living trust next to it for distribution. So in effect, what this will does, it takes whatever assets are outside, are not probated, and pours them into the revocable living trust. The revocable living trust was funded with $346,000 of personal property, residence, and some investments. Who are the trustees? The donors. This is an extremely competent man. Extremely competent. He can manage his own affairs much better than anybody else I know of. And so he's his own trustee. Nothing has changed in the way he handles his property. He just happens to be the trustee of his own trust. The trust provides he and it, and they're co-trustees, both he and his wife. They can buy, sell, trade, keep, change the trust, whatever they want to during their lifetime. It's completely revocable. The terms are simple, in addition to what I just said about giving them flexibility to use and benefit from the assets. When they're both with the Lord, the home and personal effects are distributed to the children. And the residual, what's left over, 20% goes to each child, and 10% goes to his two charitable organizations he's interested in, the Navigators and Campus Crusade for Christ. The next trust that was put together was a charitable remainder unit trust, and his business interest, the highly appreciated property, was transferred in that. Remember I said there's no tax on that kind of a transfer. And that property, half of it was transferred this last year and half be transferred next year to take advantage of the 5-year carry forward of a tax deduction. So he can, I'll get that in a moment. Again, the trustees are the donors. They're the best managers for their own assets. So they are the trustees of their own charitable remainder unit trust. Successor trustees, co-trustees, Campus Crusade, and the Navigators. When he passes away, we will take over and manage those assets in that trust for the benefit of the wife. terms. 6%, well, actually, the terms are a 9% payout every year. But the donor said, I don't need that much money. That's too much money. So, 6% is paid out to the donor. 3%, or $48,000 a year. 3% is paid out to... that line is drawn in the wrong place, but 3% is paid out to Crusade, or $8,000 a year, and two-thirds to the Navigator, $16,000 a year. You can see the great flexibility that can be gone into. He has an income tax deduction for $286,000. That'll do a lot to reduce taxes. And I mentioned the five-year carryover. If that is too much for him to use in the year of the gift, which it is, he can use. He can continue to draw on that tax deduction for 5 years. And that's why funds are placed into the trust in two separate years. So in effect, rather than just carrying out the year of the gift plus five, it's a year of gift plus six. So he will have income tax deductions, significant income tax deductions for the next 6 years. And when both he and his wife are with the Lord, beneficiaries of the trust corpus or the assets in the unit trust, Crusade one-third, Navigators two-thirds. What is two-thirds of $800,000? I didn't put that down here. About $500,000, $600,000. Irrevocable insurance trust, $600,000. Trustee, independent. Donor cannot control that. Independent trustee. Annual premium is paid from the unit trust income. Beneficiaries of trust corpus when they're both with the Lord, or when he is with the Lord, is divided equally among the children. And you can see down here in these boxes that each child will receive, we project $269,000. Crusade will receive $301,000, and the NAV is just in excess of $567,000. Go back to the preceding page. Comparison of new and old estates. And you can see that if you go back and look at the donor's objectives, you can see that what we accomplished, or what he accomplished, and we were advisors or stimulus or assistance with his own professional counselors, but we were able to help him do what he said he, or what they said they wanted to do, pardon me. And that's kind of exciting to me. I enjoy what I do. Yes, sir.
Bill, can I ask you?
Sure.
Okay. In the irrevocable insurance trust, the premium from the unit trust income, does that come from the donors or from the Campus Crusade or Navigators?
No, it comes from the donors. It's gifted to the trustee of the trust, and then he pays the premium.
And you feel that those insurance will be kept out of his estate, even though it is the donor of the charitable remaining trust, he has a right to stop paying the premium? Mm-hmm.
There's a... As the donor to the...
charitable remainder unit trust, he has the power to cease paying the premiums to the irrevocable insurance trust instantly.
He's not paying the premiums. He's making contributions to the charitable, to the trust, to the insurance trust, and then the trustee is purchasing the premiums.
Contributions come out of here.
Come out of his $48,000. Out of the $48,000, and then he makes a gift to the trust for the benefit of future beneficiaries under the gift tax exclusion. Then the trustee uses part of that gift to purchase.
To make the premium payments on the trust. Or premium payments on the trust. And it's a new insurance policy? It was originally purchased by the
trust, yes. Bill? Next illustration is from Bill. Up here, I'll wire you for some. I really feel out of it, not being able to use my overhead. In fact, I'm going to try just a bit here.
Here, let me wire you for sound here.
Oh, wire me for sound, by all means.
There you go.
Let me give Myrtle one of those books there. I don't think she got one. And I'm going to use an illustration out of that.
before I became an attorney, I was a teacher, and so I'm going to talk in my scenarios and hopefully paint pictures more than give you the financial details. It will kind of walk through what happens with some of these things, because that's partly way I feel more comfortable doing it. And if you have any questions about the details of what goes on, then fine, we can cover that as well. In that booklet, I want to first start very, very briefly by just giving you an introduction to my concept of estate planning and the way I operate. Inside your booklet, easier to read, is this little diagram. And in fact, the workbook is kind of an out-product of the process that I kind of have utilized in dealing with clients of any kind. And so it's kind of a helpful way of getting a full picture to me. Too often estate planning is just viewed as a will or a will and a trust, and that really doesn't encompass all the areas that are important. You see little satellites coming out. Yeah, the will and the trust are the hub or the center, but there are other areas that always need to be addressed. And charitable planning, as Russ has mentioned, is a part of that. Everybody ought to consider what charitable alternatives they can make to provide for the Lord's work. There is, you know, I have four children and not much of an estate so far, but I still can include the Lord's work in my plan, you know, in the event all my children and my wife and I die together. That I don't have anybody else that needs it as badly as I think the Lord's work could do. So I believe that there's planning that everybody can do. And that's a part of your centralized planning scheme. Whether it's a sophisticated degree like the unit trust or just a contingent beneficiary plan. The other things, very briefly as we go around, I won't spend a lot of time. We can go back to this, or it's in that workbook as you read through it. Incapacity, everybody ought to have a power of attorney to handle those kinds of incapacity situations. Either husbands held on wives and wives on husbands, or for single people, someone, another trusted person that there in case any disability comes up or incapacity. Property ownership. Absolutely critical. It's the most overlooked area in all of estate planning. 80 to 90% of a person's estate will pass outside of the will, potentially outside of the trust. You have to look at each individual item of property, see how it's owned. Insurance policies passed by contract. Employee benefits passed by contract, all outside of the will. Anything held in joint tenancy passes by law outside of the will. And I've seen probably the thing that is worse than no planning is poor planning, where you have people who think they have put together a good plan, but because property ownership has not been coordinated with that, they defeat all their own purposes. Healthcare is what we know now as a living will. I think that everybody ought to look one of those over and see. They're pretty much statutory by state law now. Talks about when... not when to pull the plug, that's probably a poor term, but when extra... when extra medical attention should not be used. That's not... when we think of pulling the plug, we think of not feeding or giving oxygen or general support. But this is generally, most of the living wills are written to provide for, in the event you're terminally ill and you're in a coma or something like that, in other words, you can't make the decision yourself, then this steps in to tell the doctors that you do not want those extra life-sustaining operations that would not help you live any longer, but... may keep you alive longer, but may not help the problem. And one of the things that I always point out with people that's absolutely critical is this isn't something that you file when you fill it out now and that the doctors say, oh, 48 hours has gone by, pull it out. It's something that your family keeps at home with your important papers, and in the event they need it or they deem it necessary, they bring the paper in to the physician and say, you know, he signed this living will. We don't want that extra operation. So I, you know, I think it's an important part of everything, of a plan that that may not get discussed. The last thing then is the instructions and advisors. That's just a matter of leaving all of your things together in one place, leaving a list of advisors who can help your family sort out the mess that comes in a probate or a death. And finally, often overlooked, funeral instructions. Usually, when a, you know, for a husband and wife, it's not that big a deal. If you come in for your wife or your husband and you tell the funeral director she wants a simple, you know, casket or she wants to be cremated, they say, okay. But it becomes a real issue when it's children coming in or relatives coming in and saying, I think he wanted this, or he told me that he wanted to be cremated. And you've got all the family sitting around, and the funeral director starts going through the pearl caskets, and I'm sure that he would have wanted this. Tremendous pressure. And if you don't think so, talk to somebody who's gone through that. And you'll find that there is a tremendous amount of pressure on outside family members who are called upon to make that decision with all the other relatives sitting around. And you just feel like a heel. And those things can be avoided. Okay, that's kind of an intro to estate planning. I want you to feel free at any time to ask any questions, either now or later, related to any aspect of estate planning, because that's really why I'm here.
Is this going to vary from state to state that you live in?
Which part? The general plan, no. There are statutory, like living wills in almost every state. They may vary. Power of attorneys are good in all states. The wills are getting more and more uniform, though there is some degree of difference. Property ownership may vary with respect to community property states and regular common law states. It may not mean much. Western states, there are 8 common law Western states. Everybody else, with the exception of Louisiana, has a different kind of, or a simple program.
What if you're single and you've made a will and you made your charitable funding arrangements and now you get married? This will have to be redone, doesn't it? If your husband's...
Yeah. Well, actually, marriage is typically...
On the charitable planning, though, can that remain the same? I mean, it's an agreeable thing between
the two of you. Yeah, again, it depends a little bit, because what happens a lot of times when you get married is you put things into joint tenancy. Yeah. You know, now your names are both on the property, your names are both on the bank. Well, you know, and I said, with respect to property ownership, all of a sudden you've negated your will, because there isn't anything passing underneath your will except your personal items. And then under all states, husbands or spouses have a right to certain things anyway.
Yeah,
sure. So, it is very important.
So your charitable planning would have to be replanned.
That's right. Pretty well goes out the window.
Of course. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I could just share something with you that we're familiar with. If you establish a living will, I would encourage you to watch out for the suicide clause in any laws of life insurance policies. Because all life insurance proceeds are not being paid when, in effect, a living will was exercised within, most companies have had 1 year, or it's a 2 year suicide clause. I don't believe that it will head up or stand in the federal courts, but there is some significant debt proceeds that are being held.
You know, that's very interesting. I don't know if I hadn't really thought about it from that perspective. One of the things that I take comfort in, I guess, is that most of the living wills now are statutory. And I have a feeling that that's going to help when it comes to the court, that it's not just a legal separate document that people are providing in a whole variety of different terms, but there is, you know, the actual format is in the statutes. And so that may help, but that's an interesting clause. It may be, I mean, that's something that would be interesting looking at from an insurance perspective.
Especially when your plan calls for large amounts of insurance inside an irrevocable trust, and that trust is created to buy assets from the estate,
mm-hmm.
and you have an unlegal trust, you have a lot of pressure from payment and filing of estate tax returns, and it just adds interest, of course.
Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah, that's a good point. Let me get into a scenario for you. That's the fun part. I'm going to cover two very unusual scenarios and one very usual scenario. But I do that kind of to show you the whole variety, the spectrum of what's available. And I think sometimes we... It's easy as a planner to settle into a few things that you feel comfortable with and then kind of push everybody into that format. And what I want to do is kind of explode that, and that's one of the benefits of being in the kind of job that I'm in, is I see all different kinds of situations in all different kinds of places, and the usual kind of... They lived overseas, had four children. He worked overseas in what would be considered by insurance companies a dangerous location, South America. So it was very difficult to get insurance. That comes in a little bit later. His parents were fairly well off. Not extremely well off in terms of living style, because most of what they owned was in real estate. But the land happened to be in the middle of a very fast-growing city that has just recently taken off. Could be like Orlando or Santa Monica or Dallas or something like that. When the father then died, holding about a $2 million estate with respect to the real estate. About $1.5 million of it was in real estate. Everything, simple will, went to his wife. But because of she was then single and elderly at the time, she wanted to pass it on to her son now, so that the estate tax would not come due in her estate, because a very interesting thing happened. Right after his death, the area around the land that they owned began to build up with shopping centers. And the land, within a year's time, had gone from being worth $1.5 million to being worth $3 million. And within a year and a half later, it was worth $5 million. Well, you could see the problem of beginning to try to pass that on to family and the potential estate tax. The potential estate tax in that bracket would be, it would be over $2 million on the estate. That's just in taxes. So, they were able to do some immediate kinds of planning and through an installment sale by the mother, got that property immediately into the son's name after the death of the husband. But the problem became then that the son's estate began to escalate. So this $5 million now is all in his estate. Well, he's in a South American country, dangerous occupation. He's thinking, what happens if I get killed? Half of my estate is gone. Or if my wife and I get killed. And so, he says, I'd like to gift off some interest to my children or to other relatives. The problem became then estate tax return. The estate tax return was filed on the father, property claimed at about $1.5 million. What happens when you come back a year and a half later and you sell that piece of property for $5 million? Well, the government has a fit, and they go back and they flip that estate tax return and they retax the whole estate. And it can mean endless kinds of problems. And so the attorneys said, this is such an unusual piece of property. It's grown so fast that we don't want you to sell it for 3 years till we get by the statute of limitations on the estate tax return. And so it's escalating. Well, what we did was we set up a family limited partnership, because he did want to pass on the assets to his children, but he didn't want them to actually control those assets. The nice thing about a family limited partnership, this is where we go to the diagram on there. You can see the important factors that I've listed there. Those are the things that we took into consideration. But let's go and look at a family limited partnership. I want to first cover the advantages, which aren't on your sheet and going to be difficult to see, but at least it'll help me read them. The first thing is you can pass on the value of a parent's estate to the children without giving up any control. Limited partnerships have general partners and they have limited partners. The general partners have all of the dealings, general partners have all of the power with respect to control of the property. The limited partners just have an interest, kind of like owning stock. Well, less than owning stock because you have no vote. So it becomes very good. You can pass on interests in limited partnerships to children or other people and never give up any of the control. In a limited partnership, if you're the general partner, regardless of what percentage you own, you control the whole thing. So you can pass on parents' estate. We could pass on an amount equal exactly to the gift tax exclusion, even though we couldn't value the property. The key here was, the tough part was, how do you pass on to the children an interest? Because, you know, if you pass on a percentage, you've got to value the property in order to get the value of the percentage. But through some language in the document, what we did was we gifted a $10,000 interest to each child, which was the amount of the exclusion from each parent. And so that when that property is valued and sold in 3 years, they will go back to year one and say, what was a $10,000 interest at that time? And it'll be valued at that time, but it will not call for an evaluation at this point. So it's kind of a tricky mechanism, but provides protection against creditors. Great value of family limited partnerships. What does a creditor get, even of a child? He gets a potential interest in a limited partnership. No control, no ability to get any income. It's not very valuable. Unlike if he passed on a percentage interest, joint tenancy or an interest, you know, you put all your names of the children on the deed, then that creditor gets an in to the property. Here they get an in to a personal property item. So it's very good. Even if the parent is sued, as a general partner, what can you get? Very little. And you can spray income to the children. What's going to happen in 3 years is that property is going to be sold and it's going to be invested. Okay, now income is going to come to the children through the investments because they will own a portion of the limited partnership. And it'll be taxed to each child over the age of 14. So it'll be a great opportunity for the kids to pay for their own college expenses. You want to shut off the income? You just change the investment of the partnership. You're the general partner. You can regulate the amount of income coming on to the children. Neat tool. And this is the diagram of basically how it works. We took that land and we put it into a partnership. We made mom and dad 5% each general partners, 45% each limited partners. They will gift every year portions of their limited partnership interest on to the children. So it works out to be kind of a nifty tool. And I'll give you back to Russ for the next scenario.
How large or how small do you deal with that land? I mean, if you want a home, do you go that low? Or
you can. Any amount of money can go into the limited partnership or any amount of property or whatever. It just depends on how you want to divide it up for the purposes. I just finished putting a $100,000 piece of cabin up in Breckenridge into a limited partnership. And it was primarily because the parents had an estate of about $1.5 million. Well, that means there was about $300,000 I couldn't protect in estate taxes. And so by putting it into the family limited partnership, they can gift it off to the children, but they still maintain the total control over that cabin. So it gets it out of their estate. So it's really, you know, this was a big example, but
by the way, let me point out something that Bill didn't point out. So far, there is no charitable aspect of that agreement he's working on. And he is working on behalf of the Navigators. He's representing the Navigators. At this point, the donors has so many problems that he can't get to charitable giving. I mean, he's giving personally. But his issues with his estate are a lot more complex than so we're working with him. And Bill is working on behalf of the Navigators. Thank you, Bill. I'll go ahead, and since I've started this way, I'll finish this way. Next scenario is a much different situation than the first two. Couple approached, got a letter. We have a little publication called Plan and Provide. That's this, and it's a different format now than then, but on the back of a Plan and Provide about a year and a half ago, I got a handwritten letter from this individual saying, would we be interested in a piece of real estate in exchange for a unit trust that was valued around $650,000? And that's how we got started on this particular project. He is 70, she is 56, no children, financial needs, retirement. He's in good health. She's in fair health, has some heart problems. Interestingly enough, once we got into the negotiations, we discovered that although he was extremely enthused about making a charitable gift to the Navigators, his spouse did not share that enthusiasm. Wasn't against it, but wasn't too sure it was a good idea. Their objectives are laid out, not unusual. Obviously, the last objective or plan to make a gift of the Lord's work was not quite as strong on her behalf. We got into the negotiations or discussion with him, and he was wanting to transfer, as I said, a piece of property worth about $650,000, about 4.8 acres of land, located in a growing metropolitan area. I'd seen the land. It was very buildable. It was a good piece of commercial real estate. We discovered that the property was the primary asset in this couple's estate. The vast majority was this piece of property. Second largest piece was their home. That is not the kind of thing you give away. We also discovered that the owners were hard-pressed or were having difficulty making payments on notes. Notes were about $250,000 or $240,000, I think, if I remember correctly. Instead of a charitable gift, or instead of a charitable remainder unit trust, which I illustrated earlier with that would the donor receive a lifetime income, we proposed a bargain sale. And here's the results of the bargain sale, which they entered into year before last. The property was valued at $650,000 because it was a piece of a property that he had sold earlier. The cost basis was zero. Major capital gains tax coming up. Donor's tax bracket was 28%. In the agreement, they gave a little more than 15% interest in the property to the Navigators. Undivided interest. Value of the gift, $100,000. That was the value of the tax deduction. It was an appraised piece of property. The Navigators purchased 50% undivided interest for $300,000. As I mentioned, the notes were $240,000, pardon the misprint. And the donor, the donor used our payment to pay off the notes. Or, in effect, we assumed the notes. We had to pay them off at the bank. The IRS considers if you give a piece of property to a charity that has a debt attached to it, the IRS considers that release of debt as a capital gain. So you have to pay a tax on that. So, obviously this is all worked out in advance, the donor had a capital gain tax of $56,000, and there was enough cash in our purchase price to more than cover that tax obligation. The result was the donor was able to keep the property, which was becoming questionable. They made a $100,000 gift to the Navigators, and they have maintained an asset of about $200,000 in their estate to provide for their retirement. And right now there's a contract on the land, and we hope to have it sold within a few months. Questions on a bargain sale? Bill? This is the Bill and Rush.
The back and forth. Feels like I just sat down. I know. I just put that in backwards. I'm going to skip. There's a part in there about what's called a luxury trust, and that is another very specialized trust. I'll just highlight very quickly the advantages to something like that. For an elderly or disabled person, who would qualify, who obviously is already on Medicare, but whose estate is rather limited. Medicaid, which is the state program, Medicare is a federal program, Medicaid kicks in at generally about an income level of, or an asset level of $2,000. So what happens so many times with Alzheimer's disease or other kinds of diseases where it's just a matter of time before a person goes through their estate, you pay out all, everything that's left in your estate until you get down to the level of $2,000, and then Medicaid kicks in. Well, when your estate gets down that low, then obviously you may live on for several years. You've got no discretionary kind of income. All of your Social Security and everything else is going toward the payments of, say, a nursing home and everything else. You don't even have the money to get your hair done, to buy the reasonable necessities of life. And it can be a luxury trust is a way of, you know, of providing human dignity back into the situation in a legal context. It's set up as an irrevocable trust for the benefit of the person, for the benefit of the elderly or disabled person, which means that no creditor can get at that those assets, nor can it be used to pledge toward Medicare. It is set up specifically only for discretionary items. Hence it's termed the luxury trust. If in the terms of the trust it says to pay for maintenance or to pay for support, then that has to be pledged toward Medicare. But if it's set up only for discretionary or luxury items, then those items can be paid for out of the trust for anything that the person needs or desires that is of a discretionary nature. And if you are setting it up, or let's say for an elderly parent or for a disabled child, you can place an asset into that trust and it will not be taxed to you. It will be taxed to the child or to the parent. Then at the end, when that parent or child dies, then the trust asset can go on to your children, to another remainder man, something like that. So the asset is held for the benefit, but it is not, it's not eaten up where other means could be used to pay those costs. So that's a little not often used trust, but I think one that is very interesting. I want to get on real quickly now, since I see by the clock on the wall, to one thing that I think is the most overlooked area, maybe besides family limited partnerships. It's not the most overlooked because it's used quite often, but it's the most valuable overlooked thing. I'm just going to say it because I can't use the overhead right now. There are only four basic kinds of estate plans. I don't care if you have $5 or $5 million. There's only four basic kinds of estate plans that you can have. First is a simple will. The second is a will with a trust inside of it. The third is a revocable living trust, unfunded. And the last one is a fully funded revocable living trust. And I don't care if you're a millionaire or a bum, those are the only four kinds of plans that you have. Generally, the state has a simple will for you, even if you haven't written one. And I want to talk to you real briefly about the advantages of the revocable living trust fully funded and what it can do for you or what it can do for relatives. It's a tremendous tool for a variety of different reasons, and this isn't in your handouts.
It isn't?
No. Although it is on this sheet, this handout over here. What I've got is an 8-page report on using revocable living trust in estate planning. And so if that seems to be something that you're interested in, pick it up because it kind of explains everything in detail. Revocable living trust can avoid the time delay for the distribution of death because it is a separate legal entity. It does not go through probate. Any assets held in the trust don't go through probate. And so at death then, those assets are immediately available for the family's use. A revocable living trust is rarely contested. You hear about wills being contested from time to time, and that's partly because wills are written and then years later they're utilized. But But a revocable living trust, because it is living, it is ongoing, is presumed to be the person's intent. They are very rarely ever contested. And another reason why they're rarely contested is they are completely private. A will is made public in probate. It has to be made public. It becomes a public document. Therefore, people can see how you distributed things and go back and say, I don't think that's really what they meant. A revocable trust is completely private. If you want to distribute unevenly to family members or do anything unusual, you can do that in the privacy of a revocable living trust, and only the successor trustee will know what actually has gone on. You avoid probate costs. Like I said, it's not part of probate, so you avoid those costs. To give you just a little example of what that can mean in California, which is fairly standard. This was in the Wall Street Journal. Give you some idea. It's hard to read, I know, but state even an estate of $200,000, the minimum fee there in California for the probate experience was $10,000. And you can see it kind of goes on up. So
that's a fee charged by attorneys.
That's the cost between the attorney and the court costs. Mm-hmm. So it can be significant. It voids ancillary probate. If you own property in another state, other than the one you live in, then they will probate every piece of property in that state wherever you live. So that means you could have, if you own property in four or five states, even if it's nothing more than a lot, you will wind up probating in each one of those states in what's called an ancillary probate. It's not a complicated procedure, but it can be a time-consuming procedure. A trust can live in any state. A will is always probated under the state where you live, regardless of what the laws are like there. And the laws are becoming more uniform, so this isn't as great a deal as it used to be. But a trust can live anywhere. You could live in Colorado and have a trust in Texas, and have your trust in Texas if the Texas laws were better. You know, a lot of people in Oregon, for example, Oregon has a separate state inheritance tax that kicks in at a very low level. They've just changed it because they found out that nobody, you know, the elderly people are leaving. But there were states like that. Well, what they did, you know, what a number of people did, I set up a trust, you know, 2 years ago, where the people live in Oregon now, the trust lives here in Colorado. We have a soak-up tax, which means that there is, the state tax doesn't come into play, and so it's a good place to die, in a sense. But anyway, so the trust lives here, and the people live in Oregon, and that's an advantage of the trust. Provides for management of assets. In the event of disability, or incapacity or something like that, there is a vehicle already in place. You don't have to, your relatives don't have to go to court and have a conservator appointed for your estate or a guardian for you, which you've already chosen who that person is going to be in advance. And you can separate assets for estate tax protection. I use this quite a bit with doctors. To give you an example, because of the varying degrees of liability, if you have a high degree of liability, either currently or in your past, and you know, and a lot of times the husband does and the wife doesn't, and so how can you protect then the estate? Typically, all the assets that you own now are owned by the trust. That's what this revocable are owned now by the trust. Okay, within the trust then, we have two separate trusts. We have a wife's trust and we have a husband's trust. What does that do? Separates the assets in a legal format between one and the other. Well, what do we put in each? Husband was a doctor, let's say. Even when he retires, he has ongoing liability for claims that could have been done years ago. And unfortunately, with the medical malpractice nowadays, you have to pay an extremely high premium to have past misdeeds covered after you retire and quit your practice. So it was a big area. Or a small businessman. In the wife's side, we put the house, we put the stocks, we put the bonds, we put any cash or liquid assets that are there. The husband's side, we put the automobiles, we put the stock from the professional corporation, we put anything that has any inherent liability. We separate those things out. Because if anybody's going to be sued, it's going to be the husband. And so by doing that, then, within this trust document, and then as items are put in the trust, we just separate them between the two. Husband and wife are both trustees of both trusts, so you don't lose any ownership, except you have legally separated your assets, so in case of any suit or anything like that, then husband and wife's assets are held separately. Even in a case where one is terminally ill, the other one is not, how much of the assets are you going to have to pledge towards one's health? Well, if you don't separate the assets, if there isn't a clear distinction, chances are you'll wind up having to pledge both people's assets. You can separate the assets within the trust. One more, just a quick little diagram. And these things are in this handout if you're interested. I'm just a very strong proponent of utilizing the revocable living trust where it's appropriate, because it has so many advantages of being the basic model. And this is what your plan somewhat looks like. Pretty hard to see, I know. All of your property is held up there in various ways by the trust. Okay, as we come down in the planning then, you still have wills, which pour over, as Rutz mentioned. You have a power of attorney, which takes care of being able to administer any property that comes into your name in the event of disability. You're in a car accident. You go into a coma. Claims come into you personally. How do you get it into the trust? Well, you take the power of attorney in, and your wife or your husband can put it in for you. Letter of instructions telling what you want done. A memorandum should accompany your will, which describes how you want personal property distributed. You can do that now without having to change your will every time. You just have a personal property memorandum. You can sign it and date it, and you can change individual asset ownership to anybody you want. It's a great tool. It's kind of done for the elderly women and gentlemen who are living on their own, and they change their will every week depending on who comes to visit and who calls. That's what that's for. And then it can ultimately go on down to family. This is the same plan that J. Paul Getty has or had. And it's the same plan that I have. I mean, that's real contrast if you know my estate. But all you begin to do then is put boxes out to the side here. This is your basic plan, but you could put an insurance trust here. You could put a family partnership here. You could even include a family foundation here if you wanted to. All kinds of different tools. You just broaden what it is. And the last sheet in your handout is kind of a potpourri of different estate and financial planning options. Some of them you'll be familiar with. Others of them, I would imagine you probably haven't heard of. But those are my top 24. Some of them I've only used once. A couple of them I haven't used at all. Some of them I use almost every day. But it gives you some feel for the fact that not everybody has the same thing. There are a whole variety of different tools to utilize. One of the things I want to make available to you is this workbook, this estate planning workbook that we've developed, has in the back of it an inventory. Same kind of inventory I use in my law practice. What we are making available to people now, we make it available to you as well, is if you want to read through that workbook and fill out that inventory and send it back into us, we will provide an estate analysis for you with recommending the kind of tools that you might utilize in your plan. Yeah?
Could you give the recommendation? Is it a software or something that you do?
It's modified. It's something that I've developed. It's not real long. It's not like your standard computer printout that you get from an insurance company or something like that. And it's not. And those are readily available. And it's not that those aren't valuable. It's just that I found too many times. This is very easy to understand. It's written like the workbook is in terms of recommendations, and so that you can follow it. And what is done is it lays out the basic plan, and then it has a section that includes charitable alternatives. So it gives you some different alternatives that you can utilize in your planning for a charitable purpose as well as your general regular plan that would be recommended by any attorney.
Would you that we send to your office, or it's to you?
Mm-hmm. You can send it right into the business card that's on there, in the back. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have an office here at the Navigators. And so I'll stop with any questions. Now, we put out a plan and provide four times a year, which gives you just general information on all different kinds of estate and financial planning. I think it's pretty good. I wish I could say we did it, but we found a company that does a very good job, and so we just write parts of it now. But we like to help in any way we can. That's really what we're here for. And I think what Russ mentioned was we are not under tremendous, we're not under pressure to produce, which enables us to really be person-oriented in terms of the planning. And that's the thing that we stress. There's not an obligation in that for any of my services or for Russ's. So I'm sorry, I kind of cut off your last section there, but
you heard all night.
But I felt the need to kind of wrap it up, and we did have another scenario. It was really interesting too, but you know, you can kind of go on with a lot of different variety of things that we come. But I guess what we'd like to do is make a scenario for you, not that we'll use you in a presentation, but that's primarily what we do is we take a look at where people are and kind of look at those pertinent factors and then give them some recommendations about what their plan might be. That's what I'll do as long as the Navigators continue pay me to do that. So it's a nice deal.
On the plan provider to sign up for a card, you're also if you sample a card, you can look it over and decide if you want to become involved.
How's it possible to get on your mailing list?
You still plan provider?
Yeah. You just fill out that card.
Yeah. Card.
Oh, the other thing here is if you wanted, you want this information on the revocable living trust?
Okay.
This is something we developed. I could not find any good information that was easy to understand on a revocable living trust. Lots of technical information that talked about it. So that's why we kind of put that together. And it does a pretty good job of simplifying things.
Any questions?
A couple. One is, I'm right in the middle of some of this now. How soon can I talk with one or both of you about
this weekend? Where is it available?
This afternoon?
Mm-hmm. If you're dealing in the state, there's the expert. I'd be glad to meet with you, but Bill is...
Yeah, I don't know. It depends. You have some concerns over your retirement plan and
that was one thing, whether was the decision or not. Retirement plan to do.
I meet with both of us if you want to.
Yeah, it wouldn't take long for that, but then anything else might take a little time.
Sure.
Fine. That'd be a good place to start.
That personal property memorandum where you're talking about people who, older people who somebody gives
it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It keeps them from being able to give their property. What were you saying about that?
Oh, okay. What used to be the case was... you had to, if you want any designation in terms of property, had to be in the will.
Yeah.
And so what would happen is, you know, they would leave items of personal property in the will to different people, and then they would want to change that.
Yeah.
And so then they have to bring in an attorney, get a codicil or an amendment done to the will, have it re-executed with witnesses and a notary every time.
Yeah.
And so what they've done now is they've created this personal property memorandum.
Yeah.
That you can include with the will, and you can designate out, and it can just be a list dating the item of property, the date, and your signature. And if you want to change it or if you want to add, all you do is cross out the previous thing and write the new one with the new date, or you just add it on there. And it doesn't require a witness, and it doesn't require a notary.
Now, what was this you were saying about my mother is 87, and she's going through... You know, somebody comes in and says, oh, you know, I want your house, sure, here.
Yeah.
You know, when you were saying that, I thought of her, you know, that It's personal property they could keep her from giving away.
Now, when you say that, is she giving away substantial assets that she's going to need?
Well, there's just a situation that came up recently with someone who wants to stay with her, but they said to her, well, look, I'll take care of you if when you die you leave her house. Well, now, they're not considering her children. And of course, being her daughter, I have to watch out for people like that.
That's right.
But, you know, is there some way of keeping her from, outside of getting a medical doctor to say that medically she's incompetent to make that type of decision, right?
Very often.
I just
recently dealt with a situation almost exactly like that.
Yeah.
A situation where the mother has periods of coherency and periods of not.
Yeah.
And what we did, in that situation, is we put the property items and everything into a revocable trust, trust, the management of which then was in the hands of someone else for her benefit.
Okay.
And that was to guard against that kind of situation.
Of thing happened.
And you know, they were very agreeable because when you tell them what the revocable living trust does, one, it passes immediately at death. There's no administrative expenses or things like that. So if that's what you want to do, if you want to simplify the process at death, which most people do, and you want to avoid extra payment of fees and things like that, then we can put these things into a trust. Then it's always there. If you want to, Mom, you can be a co-trustee along with me or something like that, so that we co-manage these assets for your benefit. And that way, we can avoid any opportunists.
Yeah.
One of the things that I...
it's incredible how opportunists come up with a situation like that.
Well, didn't have a chance to get this up, but there's really two parts of estate planning that I get into. Preservation and distribution.
Yeah.
Preservation means from a liability standpoint, from a disability, from death, those are all potential hazards to a person. And so, your estate plan should preserve your estate through as many of those as is possible.
Mm-hmm.
The second aspect is distribution. That's making sure that your family and the Lord's work get the bulk of your estate as opposed to your creditors, opportunistic creditors, I would say.
Yeah.
The government in terms of taxes and other costs, opportunists, and what I call distant relatives, where your estate gets diffused and it winds up going to people that you really didn't desire to have it go to.
Yeah, they shouldn't get it. Okay.
Thank you all very much. It's time for lunch.